Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the LSC's Space for Thought Festival, Literary Festival. My name is Tina Farm. I'm a governor here at the school, and I'll be chairing this afternoon's event. This is the LSE's ninth literary festival, and the theme for this year's festival is revolution. As many of you are aware, 2017 marks the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. The Oxford English Dictionary defines revolution as any fundamental change or reversal of conditions. For those of us here who are committed to advancing gender equality, this is precisely what we're looking for, and I'm sure a driver of your interests in this particular event. We're looking for a fundamental change in attitudes and a reversal of the conditions that prevail and hold us back in the workplace. This is exactly what we want to see. Today's event is being hosted by LSE Power, the LSE's own professional women's network, and I'm delighted to be here on their behalf. I'm also delighted to welcome Fenella Mail-Fine and Alice Ollins to the LSE today. Fenella and Alice are co-authors of a great book. I got mine over Christmas, and it was the best Christmas present this year. But they're co-authors of a great life-changing book, Step Up, Transform Your Career One Step at a Time. And the book will be the subject of our discussion today. We've got an action-packed agenda planned for this event, so I'm going to keep my introduction short. But just to give you an idea of the agenda for the event, we plan to start with an interview session where I'll be interviewing Alice and Fenella for about 20 minutes. After that, there'll be an opportunity for some audience participation, and we'll be looking at getting you all involved in a workout for around 10 minutes. That will be followed by a Q&A, and the session will end at around 2:30. That'll be the formal end. We'll then have refreshments available for you and an opportunity to buy the book, for those of you who haven't read it, with Fenella and Alice on hand to sign it. I'd also like to remind the audience that the event is being recorded, and hopefully a podcast will be available, subject to there being no technical problems. Secondly, for those of you who haven't already done so, I'd appreciate it if you would put your mobile phones on silent. Finally, for Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for this event is LSELitFest. Capital L, capital F. So, without further ado, let's get this revolution started. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Alice and Fenella to our event. So, the questions. It's a great book.
Thank you.
It's a real read that you can't put down. Can you tell us something about what drove you to work on such a book?
Yeah. So Alice and I have known each other for quite a long time. Alice is a very, very old childhood friend of my husband's, and so we've known each other actually even since pretty much before we started working, just when our kind of respective careers were starting to form. And we've always had feminism in common, a desire to progress our careers, to champion women, something that's been a kind of thread throughout our conversations over the years. Usually those conversations were happening at parties, we'd come together and, you know, we'd be talking. And over time, Alice's career as a journalist progressed to pretty amazing places like The Times and Marie Claire. And I moved from being a corporate lawyer at Slaughter May & Linklaters then to be an equity fund manager at JP Morgan. And then I re-qualified in organisation behaviour and I started working as a coach back in the same kind of organisations I worked in before. And the more that we were having these conversations and I was observing that the things that I was bringing into these corporates, like the executive coaching and the women's leadership programs, were things that our friends didn't have access to, people who were outside of those organizations or who maybe weren't a high potential at Goldman Sachs, you don't get access. And actually, a lot of this information is not rocket science. A lot of this information is quite simple, but you need to know it, and you also, really importantly, you need to know how to implement it. So that kind of conversation and that background is where Step Up started.
I think there was also an element of just timing about it. It felt like I was writing at the time and you were working and kind of having frontline experience of speaking to women, and I was on the other side reporting a little. I mean, my main area of interest for journalism is fashion, but I was working at the Times and kind of within the Times too, supplement. You know, I could hear what was going on, and I think we felt like there is obviously change in the air, there were more and more stories about it, and the actual catalyst for writing the book came from an email that Fenella received from someone in Colombia, and that was kind of the final straw. But I think we'd been talking about it, and we realised that we came from these two very different aspects in our careers, myself on the much more creative side and Fenella having had a very corporate career, and we kind of realised, well, there's no one, number one, there feels like a time to have a new book and something definitely more youthful, but also that what we had together was two very different points of view, but we shared a lot of values. Well, we have, our values are very kind of in sync, but we come at them from different points of view. So I think there were lots of elements that were like behind starting, but then you always just have to take that leap of faith. And we kind of came up with the idea of writing the book, and then we're like, okay, so now we need to write a book, what do we do? So we literally Googled, like, writing a book proposal, which doesn't sound very professional at all. And actually, there's quite a lot on the internet about how to write a book proposal, which is essentially writing a sample chapter and doing some kind of market research and outlining. So it is weirdly like a simple step into writing a book. And then I had some contacts with literary agents through my kind of journalism context, so we just sent it out, and it was a massive leap of faith. And we say it in the book, you know, it's from where, like, people on the other side look at us and like, oh wow, they've written a book on women's careers, wow, they must be so sorted, and, you know, planned this all out. And it's like, well, we never planned to write a book together.
We actually started by doing the event. But we already had, we met our agent then. We'd met our agent, and we thought, you know, let's kind of. We had this feeling. Alice had written an article about people wanting to meet offline, that people wanting to come back together in person and kind of real life and networks.
Like these type of things.
This kind of thing. And we were like, well, let's do that and just see what happens. So we said to this agent who we'd just met at United Agents, which was still, I think, the most nerve-wracking thing when we first met her. It was really, I think my hand was shaking while I was drinking the water. And we said to her, we're just going to do this event. And then just before, she's like, oh, by the way, I've just invited some editors from some publishing houses to come. You know,
which was essentially basically just all our friends, people that we knew in a nice space, which we'd kind of pulled together very quickly.
And she said, what would be your dream thing? And I was like, well, Random House. And she was like, yeah, well, that's not going to happen, but fine. And then she brings this woman up to us and says, oh, this is the editor from Random House. And she grills me. I think you were talking
about getting a crisp.
And she grills me for about 20 minutes, and then she says, oh, thanks, I actually can't stay for the event, and she leaves. And so we thought, oh my God, well, that was terrible.
You said this is awful, we've been totally right. I did catch the end of it. I saw Fenella looking desperate from afar, so I ran over to try and save her. And then she left, and Fenella was like, that was awful.
She didn't even stay for the event.
She didn't smile. She, like, barely looked at me. This is definitely not going to get this. And I was like, actually, you know what? I bet she finds us. Like, it's just one of those situations where it's so bad, it maybe might be good.
Yeah, and then the next day, they emailed. It turned out she was pregnant, and she felt terrible. So the next day they signed us. So that's how it happened.
Okay. So, I was really keen to find out your why for writing the book, particularly in the style that you've written it, because there are so many books out there on, you know, career development, women's leadership, empowering women. It's very unique to what I've seen before, but I was curious about your why.
Well, I think we, like, kind of backtracking a bit about both of our backgrounds, and that Fenella, so when we decided to write the book, we obviously had to write that proposal that we pulled out of the bag somehow, but we had to plan the book, and Fenella had very strong ideas about the themes that should be in the book, and those themes very quickly became our chapters, and there are 10 chapters, and each is kind of themed for a different career skill, and then I think we wanted to use my skills as a features writer, and something I do as my job is to process kind of difficult information and make it readable and hopefully kind of engaging and entertaining. And so we felt like if Fenella stayed very committed to her side of the bargain, which is how we have continued in everything that we do, because we now do lots of events and collaborate with brands and stuff, but it always seems to come back to we stay very true to our own skill sets, which are completely different. I mean, they are actually, we're becoming a weird step-up amalgamation of one person through two kind of sides of her brain. But Fenella was very strict on how she, not strict, but she was very sure of how the book should be formatted, and I was very sure about the tone of voice. And we were very sure of our roles, but then the first weekend of writing our book was probably one of the most painful weekends of our life, and that was that Fenella, and the way that we actually wrote the book was that Fenella did the academic research and had a lot of the information already to hand for the different themes, and then she would deliver me with this brilliant kind of content, which then I would turn into something less dense. Fenella's became less dense anyway as she wrote it, as it got through the book, but as the final product. But the first weekend, a proof of how important it is to communicate with your partner is that Fenella was still very much in her corporate world, and I think I've pulled her out of it a little bit. And I was still writing about frilled sleeves and stuff, so I was like in a totally different place. So she sent me this content, and I wrote it up. And as I always say, like, I added way too many kind of metaphorical bows and hearts. And then I sent it back to Fenella, and I just didn't hear anything back from her, like not a reply or anything.
I don't like confrontation, so I just read it and I was like, oh my God. And I just thought, I just not going to deal with it.
So we had a crisis meeting on the Monday, and we realised that Fenella needed to come a little bit more kind of into the middle away from her corporate side, and I needed to lose the bows and hearts a little bit. And so we after that one meeting, we found our step-up voice. And I think, I was interested, as you were asking the question, I was interested to hear from you what you thought was so different about it. Because for us, it's very natural what it is now. But
It clearly is a book written by women for women. But it's a book written in a facilitative way, in a caring way, in an understanding way of the issues women face. In fact, one of the questions I've got down to ask is something that I've struggled with, but I found the answer in the book. And it really is a workbook. You know, a book you read and you think, okay, right. It is a workbook, and the commitment to ourselves as women, finding time every day, that consistency was really refreshing, because it is something that, you know, we've got to care for ourselves.
I mean, it makes us really happy that you say that, because that's exactly what we were driving for. Mm-hmm. So the kind of, as Alice said, there was this email that I got that was the real kind of thing where we said, okay, we've got to write this book. And I got this email from this, I do lots and lots of kind of delivery leadership stuff. I'd done a women's leadership course for a big legal training organization, and they had streamed it online. A female partner in a law firm in Colombia in South America had emailed me and said, I've really been affected by your program, which kind of had some of the broad themes from the book. And can you recommend what I can read to find out more? You know, where can I go to find out more? I was like, well, obviously your firm could bring me over to Colombia, but otherwise I'll recommend you some books. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to go away. And everything in there, it's based on, you know, thousands of coaching hours and training, but it's also based on real academic research. And it is really well researched, despite the kind of the tone that feels light and enjoyable. It's got a real core. And along with the tone that feels that is really enjoyable, and so I went out there and thought, what can I recommend to her? And I looked through all the books on my shelf. I have a lot of these books, and I thought, you know, there's nothing here that has the foundation in research and fact, but is actually something I could apply. So there are lots of great books that I read them, but then I think, well, how do I implement that myself? And so that was exactly what we wanted to create, something that you could pick up and you could read it and say, yes, I agree with that, but you would go further than that and you would say, actually, now I know how to work through it.
Yeah, I mean, I also like the fact that the focus is clearly on leadership and women progressing within organisations. And one of the issues I recognised was the imposter syndrome. This is as women start to progress, this feeling that, well, I'm going to be caught out. I'm not the real deal. You know, a man can, you know, there could be 12 attributes for a job and a man have 5 and he thinks that he's qualified for the job. You know, a woman might have 11 out of 12 and still worry about that one. And it was interesting in the book, all the, you know, very competent and very successful women who suffer and who admitted to suffering from it. So, how do you go about slaying this inner imposter? You know, really, really dealing with it. Do you have any tips for those perhaps who haven't read the book?
Well, I would actually challenge you to say that I don't think the book is all, I don't think it is only aimed at leadership. I think something that we set out early, like that we kind of make clear very early on in the first chapter, is about defining your own success, and actually it isn't about becoming a leader, it's about working out what your success is, and whether that is, you know, staying at a lower level in your career but having incredible work-life balance, or having a flexible approach to your career, or whether that is kind of reaching, you know, sitting on a board by the age of 35. I think the book applies equally, and so I would say, and in the same vein, I think imposter syndrome can affect you at any stage, and not just when you're applying for new jobs.
And it does affect men and women.
Yeah.
Although I think there's some research that says it's slightly more common in women, but I think it takes hold in us maybe a little bit more.
Yeah, we talk a lot about in our confidence chapter, and imposter syndrome, as we say, is a kind of is a second cousin to confidence, and is that, you know, one of the reasons that women suffer is because we listen to the kind of mental ticker tape that's always going on in our heads, and we doubt ourselves constantly. And the reason that we have this very active, there are lots of reasons from childhood and from the way that we're brought up and nurtured as girls to be kind of good little girls who always do things very nicely and are perfect at everything. And I think that's a whole other conversation. But I think the way that it affects you in terms of your confidence in your career is that we listen to those doubts in our heads, and where men might kind of just plow on through, we listen, and that voice that's challenging us makes us more empathetic, and it, you know, you can change. And actually Fenella's got, if you should do your belief cycles, explaining about kind of practically. But I think with confidence and imposter syndrome, it's also about just accepting that we all have it, and we all have it at different stages, and that it's not, you don't have imposter syndrome or not have it, where just in the same way that you don't not have confidence or have it. This is all a kind of nebulous grey area that can affect us and can change on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis. And certainly we aren't immune to it at all. It depends on the situation and how we feel that day and what the day, how the day pans out. So I would say that, first of all, not labelling yourself as someone who suffers from imposter syndrome is probably the most important thing. I don't know if you want to kind of...
Yeah, I think the belief cycles are really important, but it would probably take me the whole talk to explain. I mean, it's really about changing your thought processes. And there's a whole chapter in the book about changing your thought processes to become more confident. I think, as Alice says, that label that you give yourself, so we all have these kind of schemas that we go through our life with, like, we talk about it in the book, actually, in the context of tiredness. So, oh, I'm so tired. Oh, I'm a kind of person that gets really tired. Oh, yeah, I feel really exhausted. And that is your schema that you go through, that you're an exhausted person, that you're a person without a lot of energy. And the problem is your self-talk becomes the self-talk of a person who doesn't have a lot of energy. Therefore, you have less energy. Therefore, people perceive you to have less energy. Therefore, people treat you as somebody. So, and it's all a cycle. And imposter syndrome is exactly the same thing. So you're sitting there and you're thinking, oh, my God, I'm this secret underperformer in this sea of incredible, you know, especially somewhere like LSE where everybody is so bright and everybody is so outwardly successful. And you're looking around saying, oh, you know, any day now someone's going to find out that I don't actually know that much and I've only done well in this paper because I spent ages on it and it happens to be the topic, and if it had been on another topic I wouldn't have been able to do it. And then you start to appear unconfident, people treat you as if you're an unconfident person, your belief that you're an imposter is confirmed, and it all goes round. So I think stepping out of that and being very conscious when those thoughts do take you is really important. But I think also being aware that other people suffer from it too. Certainly personally, that was a turning point for me when I was a trainee lawyer. I sat with a very, very senior partner. And I can remember, I think I got on very well with him. And I remember saying to him once, well, you know, I'm a bit worried because, you know, I went to Oxford and everyone thinks I'm really clever, but I don't really know anything about it. And he was like, oh, don't worry. I felt like that for 30 years. Every time I go into a meeting, I'm worried that someone's going to find out that I don't really know the law. And I think actually just that is really helpful. You know, we feel that way. Really, you know, Tina feels that way. You look at these people and you know, the thing you see outside isn't necessarily the thing that's going on inside, and that's really comforting.
I wish we had more time. It's a great book. I strongly recommend it. But could you both perhaps say one thing, one piece of advice in terms of women's, our journeys as women in the workplace?
Well, I think it's a kind of duality between the practical side of the book, which is what Tina mentioned. So we were very clear that we wanted to have these practical workouts, these 10-minute workouts, and there are 5 in each of the chapters where you can actually kind of take the information that we talk about, and we also interview some amazing women in there, and kind of the topics that we cover. And then we've created fun, engaging, practical workouts where you can start practicing those skills, because we believe that if you actually practice them in a day-to-day sense, and that's outside of the confines of your office, you know, it might be something to do with friends or in a taxi, self-promoting to a taxi driver, you know, lots of different ways of using these skills that you become more confident with them. So I think it's the practical side, and then but in line with the kind of emotional supporting, caring side that, you know, as women, as I said, you know, we're more empathetic, we tend to be more emotional beings, and it's kind of accepting that, harnessing that, and also being really proud of that. You know, we talk about equality, and you started out, you know, by talking about obviously equality, and what we say a lot and what we say in the book is that obviously we want equality, but we don't believe that men and women are the same, and we don't believe that we should be aiming or striving for sameness. We believe that women should celebrate their kind of female traits, and then hopefully that's what you get from the book when you buy it later.
Yeah, I think I completely agree with Alice. We basically always agree with each other. It's true. Yeah, except for that day. Yeah, we basically always do. But I think for me, the thing that is most important in the book is at the beginning, which is actually after the chapter on equality and sameness, we go on to success. And Alice alluded to it earlier. It's about defining what success means to you. We go very blindly, and I know that I still have moments where I do this, but I definitely was guilty of this when I was younger. Alice has a brilliant way of putting it in the book, and she says, when you read the definition of success, in the dictionary, it starts off as something that is acceptable, so it's a, you know, achievement of a goal, and then it whacks you with this actually very masculine or traditionally masculine slant, which is traditional or typically demonstrated by money and power. And I think the problem is that the definition of success, when you say successful, and it's something we kind of almost rail against, like, this person is a successful person. What that conjures up is somebody powerful, somebody who's had a lot of career progression, somebody who has a big job title, somebody who has a lot of power, and someone who's made a lot of money. And actually, we know that women in general are defining success in a much more nuanced way. In general, everything in gender is a generalization, but in general, than most men are. So men will be more likely, in general, to define success in terms of power, job title, and money. Women will be more likely to define success in terms of great relationships with their colleagues, having a real impact or making a difference, doing something that is authentic to them, along with power and money. And so in this room, the definitions of success are myriad. And if you go for a definition of success that is the dictionary definition of success, or the definition of success of the woman sitting next to you, or the definition of success of your mum or your dad, you may well not be going for the definition of success that is inside you, and therefore when you achieve it, you will feel unsuccessful. So at the heart of your career journey is really defining what success looks like to you, and then you can use all the other building blocks to go and get that success. But if you haven't done that first step, you won't ever feel successful.
That's fantastic. Well, on that note, I'm afraid we're going to have to draw our interview or conversation to a close. Ladies and gentlemen, will you join me by thanking Fenella and Alice? I'm sure you're dying to ask questions, but we do have an exercise now, some participation from the book, one of the workouts. And I'm keen that we actually have, you know, build up our energy, you know, around what we're talking about. It's not just a typical Q&A following a talk. So we're actually going to practice what Fenella and Alice have been preaching before we then go into the Q&A. So are you ready to start it?
So it's actually not in the book. It's something that we've done at a couple of events. It's really fun. You're going to have to get up and talk to people you don't know. I'm just warning you now. So it's about it's from our networking. It is about networking. And we talk a lot about networking in the book. And as we point out very early on in the book, we're not at all pitting men against women. That is not what we're interested in doing. In fact, in many themes, we draw on the way that men generally, as Fenella said, these are all generalizations, but the way that men generally go about or approach things, and the way women do, and kind of work out an amalgamation of the two, so you can kind of become the most successful version of yourself. So in terms of networking, the analogy that we use in the book is that the way that women tend to network is, we call her like the queen bee. So women like to network in like-minded networks, and we like to surround ourselves with lots of similar bees that buzz around us that we feel very, very comfortable with. And we have lots of very, very, very strong relationships, or maybe not lots, we have some very, very strong relationships, and that is our core network. And it's kind of like our girl gang, and we feel very comfortable in that. And that's great for having those strong relationships, people that you can trust, people that you can partner with. You know, Fenella and I work together very closely, and we have drawn on our kind of experience of building relationships with other women. The way that men tend to network, we said, is a bit like a spider with his web. So he builds his web much wider, and in that he'll kind of chat to a wasp or an ant, or, you know, lots of different types of insects in the garden, and his bonds will be more fragile, but his web will be a bigger web. So the conclusion we come up with is that if you can have that beehive in the middle, but also learn and take a kind of clues from the way that men do them, build their networks, and kind of also incorporate those kind of looser bonds with people who aren't similar to you, you know, different ages, different sex, different careers, you end up with a really powerful network. So with that in mind, even though we are all but one woman here, we are going to chant, or you're going to do the workout, so you explain what we're going to do.
So what we're going to do is we're going to ask you to meet somebody new. The thing about networking is that it can be a very daunting thing. So if I say to you now, network, that fills most people with horror. Most people, some people love it, but most people think, oh my God. But actually, when you think about it, it's just conversations with a purpose, and your purpose with networking is to make a connection. It's also to see if that connection might be interesting or to lead somewhere else. But the problem is that we can get you to make those connections or to network, but actually you lose it then if you don't follow through, if you don't cement that connection that you've just made. So what we're going to get you to do is we're going to get you to make a connection, but we're also going to get you to cement that connection or follow it through so that you then have the ability to follow up with that person, for example, if you want to, rather than just speaking and then just lose, you know, it's just ephemeral. So what we'd like you to do is all stand up. And So incorporated within this is also a little bit of self-promotion. We're basically working with every chapter in this book. So when I say go, not yet, we're going to ask you to find one person in this room who you do not know. It's not allowed to be the person actually who you've arrived with. One person who you do not know. We'd like you to go to them and give them a 1-minute pitch about who you are and what you're here for. And then we would like the other person to do the same thing back. And then we would like you to take a photo together, a little selfie together. And we'd like you to put it on your social media, on your Twitter or on your Instagram or your Facebook or wherever. And we'd like you to tag each other so that you can find each other again. You can also tag LSE. I think it's London School of Economics is the tag. And LSE Litfest, and we're at the Step Up Club. Not our ones. At the Step Up Club. Yeah, and then we'll be able to find you again as well. And now we would like you to go. Network.
Network.
Thank you so much for all engaging so well in our workout. Hopefully it wasn't as painful as it first sounded that it was going to be. Some people I know encountered a few technical difficulties, like we're in a basement and you can't get on the internet. But if you did encounter a difficulty, then take down each other's details. Liz and I have just sent each other an email so that we've got each other's contacts. And I did manage to post it on my Twitter, but that we can post it later. It's a really good tip, actually, for when you're networking generally, not that you're going to go around like you'll go to the banking drinks and you're going to go and like start taking selfies with the bankers from Goldman Sachs. But what you might want to do is, for example, straight away finding people on LinkedIn, as an example, is a really great way to just not take a business card and just lose it and then just never follow up again. So hopefully you enjoyed it.
That was brilliant. That was a really energising session. Thank you. It's good to have a takeaway from these sessions as well. But now it's over to you. It's for you to put your questions to Fenella and Alice. We have some roving mics. I would ask that before you ask your question, you say who you are, the organisation that you're affiliated to. So do we have questions from the audience? Yes, this lady here.
Hello, my name is Nerissa, and I'm a master's student at the London School of Economics. And my question is, how would you provide tips to those women who defined success different than their social fabrics? And it could be in terms of culture and how culture defines success for them and how they define success sometimes could be contending issues. And what would be your tips to that for them?
I think it's such a good question. Again, speaking personally, I've had to contend with that as well. When I started working at Sol Tremay, it was probably the best thing that had ever happened to my mother in her entire life. And the reality of working there was, I think, a bit different to the outside perspective of being able to go to a drinks party and say, "Oh, my daughter's so clever, she's just left Oxford and she's at Sol Tremay." And the experience that I lived there was something completely different. So I'm really familiar with that idea that actually you realise that the success that you want or that you're driving for isn't the same as the thing that maybe your family is or maybe your friendship group is. And that is something that's going to repeat itself throughout your life. I then went and had a baby, and I had a baby way before any of my friends. So when I was starting to think about work-life balance, my friends were driving their career, and they not only couldn't understand what I was doing, but some of them were actually really derided what I was doing around work-life balance, for example. Now, fast forward 8.5 years, they've got babies, and they're sending me text messages saying exactly what I was saying 8.5 years ago at the time when they didn't get it. So I think that is something that will repeat itself throughout your life. You're going to be in situations where you're out of sync, initially with your family, but then maybe with your friendship group, then maybe with your organisation. You know, you might be in a situation where your organisation is saying you need to progress. You might be in a real pyramid organisation. They're saying you need to progress every 2 years or every 3 years. But actually what you want to do is you want to deepen your knowledge, or you want to make a sideways move, and it's not an option. So that is partly about resilience, about being able to, something we talk about a lot in talks, something we talk about a lot. We do a newsletter which we send out. If you sign up on our website, this is an ad. If you sign up on our website, we do a newsletter which we send out every other week, and it's always got some kind of piece of career advice that's not in the book. And the week before last, we talked about failure and about really getting comfortable with a fear of failure, with an idea that you could fail, but you could use that as a learning experience and move on. And that kind of idea is really important in developing your resilience. So I can let somebody down, but that doesn't mean that I've failed. That just means that my definition of success is different to theirs. And I think also in that situation, you have to be extremely clear about what your definition of success is. You need to be able to articulate that to yourself, and maybe articulate that to other people. As long as you're very, very clear about that and very, very solid within yourself, then at some point you just have to push forward and kind of ignore what other people say.
Thank you. It's this lady here.
Hello, I'm Christine. I'm a master's student here at LSE. Thank you for coming. I read your book. It was excellent. I think what makes it stand out is that it is so practical, and I like that you sort of acknowledge the barriers that are there and then like how you work around it. And so my question is, you can drive your own career and you can make these decisions, and it's very important to take ownership, but how do you engage men and other groups that, like, no matter how hard you work or you represent yourself, you will face unconscious biases, and sort of getting different non-women to think about, you know, how they can sort of change some of their thought processes?
Well, I think, as we said at the beginning, there is something in the air, and there is change, but at the same time, one book, one movement, us as part of a bigger movement, isn't going to change things overnight. And I think, as we said about staying true to your own definition of success and not letting other people impose that on you, is a way to kind of empower yourself. We don't like that word. But you've got to stay true to yourself and not be pushed in lots of different directions.
I would add to that. I think there's something we talk about in the book, which is invisibility of privilege. And actually, before we wrote the book, it wasn't something that I think either of us has ever come across. But it was one of the... when people often ask us, you met these amazing... We also, in the book, we interview lots of women about their careers across a whole spectrum of industries. And what was the best thing you learned? And the thing that I always say was from this woman, Tamara Box, who is a partner in the financial... She's actually the head of the financial structuring group at a big law firm called Reed Smith, and she co-founded the 30% Club. She's a really amazing woman. And she talked about invisibility of privilege, and I think that is really relevant to what you say. What invisibility of privilege is that it's the idea that the dominant group, or the group that has comfort in that area, or in the kind of sphere that you're operating in, doesn't understand that everybody else doesn't experience things the same way. So examples would be, as women, we have invisibility of privilege often in relationship to motherhood or to parenthood. So people hand us a baby, and the first time somebody hands... I don't know how many people in here have children, but the first time somebody hands you a baby, I mean, I certainly had no idea what to do. But very quickly, I thought, well, I'm a mother, so obviously I'm going to be able to work it out. And very, very quickly, my husband had exactly the same amount of experience as I had, but very, very quickly, within about a week, I was telling him how to put on nappies, and I was telling him, you know, telling him what to do. And I just had that kind of comfort that I knew exactly what to do, and what that did in me sort of asserting that was caused him, in a way, to shrink back and say, well, she knows what she's doing, and I've lost my confidence in that. Another example would be as a white person. I go through life thinking that everybody is experiencing life as I am experiencing it, with very little discrimination in terms of my race, and that, you know, everything is just pretty much neutral to me. But we know that as a person from an ethnic minority, that lots of them will be experiencing in certain situations discrimination that I'm just not aware of. So I have invisibility of privilege in regard to my race in Britain. Or in, you know, in lots and lots of countries, actually. And what Tamara Bock said is that men have invisibility of privilege at work. So it's not, yes, there's unconscious bias, there's very severe unconscious bias, and actually unconscious bias training doesn't even always counteract the unconscious bias, although it can help. But also, they have this idea that everybody's experiencing work often in the same way that they're experiencing work. So they know conceptually that there's an issue with gender equality, but because of the way that they're experiencing work in a very neutral or positive way, they don't actually see that there is a real problem. And so sometimes it is about being vocal about that problem. Now, obviously, I think Tina made a really good point when we spoke to her before the talk, was that, you know, some of the things that we advocate women doing might be a little bit risky because there can be backlash against that. So obviously you're not going to go to the boss of an organisation and say, did you know that I'm experiencing all of this, and, you know, you have no idea. But doing that in subtler ways, talking about things, voicing it, questioning, raising the point that, you know, for example, you know, I tried to negotiate, and this was the pushback that I got. What did you get with your male colleagues, for example? Just starting that conversation, I think one of the things that we do at the end of the book is almost like a call to action to say, you know, it is each and every... The problem is not with women, right? The problem is with the structures around work that have been male-centric for such a long, long time that they are, lots of them, struggling to change, and changing too slowly for the way that we're changing, or the way that the world is changing. So we're not saying women change yourselves, but what we are saying is that if you want to progress now, you need to be smart about the situation you're in, but that you also have power. So each and every single one of us has the power to drive little bits of change. So I think that's kind of the point, that if you go in there and you make people aware of this invisibility privilege, you make them aware that things maybe aren't how they perceive them to be, things will gradually change.
Okay. Are there any more questions? Yes, please.
Hello, my name is Rachel. I'm from the general public. I've had various careers during my lifetime and various setbacks, some physical, which I've had to sort of get over, some emotional, and I'm just wondering, where is your book also targeted, or where is it targeted? Full range of working age women, or is it sort of age specifically? And what's in it for me?
Well, I think we got interviewed relatively soon after we launched from a journalist, and you often don't know a journalist when, you know, she actually came to Fenella's house and we had the interview there, and she was probably in her mid-50s. She was on about her third career and was very open about it, and put the book down on the desk, and it was just absolutely ram-packed with post-it notes, and we were just on like massive, I was like, oh, we've got to Instagram this is amazing, the best thing we've ever seen. And she was like, genuinely, every single page of this book kind of spoke to me. And as two young women, you know, we naturally are kind of, I suppose we were aiming it to women similar to ourselves, and I think that was from before we started writing the book. But in the process of writing the book, and we say this at the beginning, is that we learnt so much, and we drew on a lot of the skills that we talk about, and I think it became, or it is, as much a kind of life skills book as it is a career manual. It started off as a career manual, but it kind of mushroomed into something bigger than that. And I think, you know, confidence, I think that what we talk about in terms of relationships, communication, networking, they are all skills that apply in the workplace and beyond the workplace, and something that we feel very strongly about personally, and also in terms of women in their careers, is that, and especially now, is that You know, your job has to become part of your life. It is part of your life. It isn't a separate entity that just sits there on a different burner on your kind of hob of life. Everything is so integrated now. And I think because of that, we were very aware that we wanted it to feel like, and that's why we went for this kind of encouraging tone of voice. We wanted it to feel like a conversation with a friend, and it isn't a dry career book. And I think my mother-in-law actually read it, and she phoned me up after she got to chapter 3, and she's like, you know, number one, if I'd had this, you know, 30 years ago, it would have been brilliant. But number two, I can still take a lot out of this. She's in a difficult relationship, and she was talking about the kind of confidence side of things. And I think it really is a life skills book, which, depending on where you are in your own life, whether you're a student and you're not working yet, whether you are retired, there's something in it, because really it's about working out what you want from your life at this moment in time, and then using the skills that we talk about to achieve that, and that obviously applies in all areas.
Yes, lady at the back.
Hi, I'm Robin. I am also not an LSE student. I'm quite interested in hearing, you've mentioned over and over this idea of defining success for yourself, and I'm fascinated by that. And I think clearly that it's something you'll have to do time and time again in your life. And I think that coming through, undergraduate, postgraduate, you sort of get, there's a path of how to define success, even though it's different for everyone. There are people guiding you along that path. And that was a path that I travelled and, worked my way up to a point that I'd been wanting to get to for a long time. And then I had kids and that job no longer works in any way in my life. And so now I'm at the point that I'm trying to define success again. But I think it's interesting that I'm realizing that there have been all these structures in place through my life to help me define my idea of success. And maybe partly that is taking in those external ideas as well. And this, maybe this time round, it's a matter of doing it in a different way. But could you just talk a bit about I haven't read the book yet, but just talk about how you go through that process. I'm sure you talk about it in the book.
Yeah, sure. So, look, I think motherhood we're both mums, and I changed career out of motherhood. So I kind of get exactly what you're saying. Motherhood is probably the time in your life when your identity can shift in an unbelievable way. And often in ways that you really, really don't expect. It can kind of knock you sideways. So, I think it's really normal that at those identity shifting points, whether it is having children, whether it is breakdown of a relationship, whether it is moving to another country, all of those different big an illness, all those big shifts in your life will cause you to reevaluate your success. But the process that you can go through at that point is the same process. Actually, as an aside, I was thinking about what our next newsletter should be about, and I have this brilliant book I read about 10 years ago by this woman called Orenya Yaffa Yaffai. The premise of her book is about how we sort of inherit career ideas, so that a lot of our success definition comes from our family it's inbuilt in us. So things that, I realised that I took my children to Oxford a few weeks ago, and while we were there, I was like, you have to go to Oxford, and I was kind of joking, but I mean, my kids are young, they probably didn't get it. And I realised afterwards that I basically just told them, if you don't go to Oxford, your mum's not going to think you're great, And so our parents do these things, but they don't even realise that they're influencing our success. And what Orenya Yaffa-Yanai says is, first of all, you inherit these career ideas, and actually sometimes they're maybe not right for you, and you sometimes have to discard them along the way, but it can take a very long time. The other thing she says that I think is really powerful, which we might talk about in our newsletter soon, is about you're never too old to change career. So at each point you always think, I can remember when I changed from law to banking and I thought, I was 26, I think, 27, and I thought, oh my God, well, I'm way too old to start again. I've got to find a career which I can build on. And then when I had kids, then I changed from banking to organisational behaviour, I was like, wow, at least I can still do this in law firms and banks. You know, I couldn't change completely. And, you know, that was, and now I look back and I think, oh, that was really stupid. Well, I couldn't change career now because I'm way too old now. But, you know, of course you're not. So that's just an aside. It's always possible to change career. And people have, think about Mary Wesley, that, you know, she started writing when she was about 76. There are people do all these amazing career changes at all different points of life. So it's never, ever too late. That's just an aside. But the process would be the process that we would take you through in the book. So it's what really matters to me. That's fundamental. What are the things, the building blocks that I really need for my career at the moment? So, and you've got to be honest about that. You know, your life's pie. If you need work-life balance, don't define success by being the CEO of a FTSE 100 company, because that isn't going to happen for you, because you're not going to have a work-life balance. You need to be realistic about what you can achieve within the parameters of what you want. What motivates you? What type of person are you? Where's your tribe? And maybe what, you know, how can you build on before? And then realistic things like, you know, what we put in that pie, how much money do I need to earn, for example? You know, all of that's got to feed into your decision, and it is just this process of starting to get those building blocks and then at the end creating this vision where you create a picture, and you might not know the stepping stones to get there, but you've got a picture of where you're trying to get. And so then each decision, you've got this framework where you can say, okay, should I take this job? How does it fit in with the end goal?
And I think just to add to that, I think what you're obviously very self-aware, and you kind of know that you should be redefining your success. And one of the reasons that we've made this book really practical is because it's so difficult. Even if you know that you need to do something, actually getting there is an incredibly difficult journey. And so we, in this kind of success chapter, we've got these five workouts. And sometimes it does feel really contrived to actually sit down and think, right, now I'm going to do my 10-minute line graph of my life and my emotions and my highs and my lows. And we did an event a fortnight ago where we got everyone who attended to do these graphs and things like that. And actually, it's even just the process of giving yourself that time. I think Tina said at the beginning, you know, you think, oh yeah, I'm going to do it, and you never do it. And then you kind of beat yourself up, like, I didn't do it, and I still don't know, and I don't know what's wrong with me. But actually, if you actually sit down and give yourself that time and work through the process of these workouts, they do, you know, everything that you need to know is in your head, but sometimes it's just filtering it out and being able to kind of literally put it down on paper and see it, and maybe discard it, maybe not. But those processes are so important, and I think in our busy lives where we do everything kind of maybe a little bit half-heartedly and fit it all in, especially if you've got kids, you know, like us, we're always kind of trying to do 1,000 different things. You don't go through those processes and give them the time and energy that they deserve, because actually, you know, what you're saying, defining your success now is a hugely important thing for your next 20, 30 years, or even just your next 1 year. So I think actually giving yourself that time and committing to doing all those exercises, not just our exercises, but just having thinking time, is so important. And so obviously work through the chapter and then you'll be there.
But if I might add, because the book places you at the centre, it really does help to facilitate those transitions. And I'm going to be open that I'm going through that transition myself. You know, my daughter's here at the school doing a master's degree. I've got to work out what I want to do for the next 20 years. And the book has been hugely helpful with that. So thank you.
Thank you.
So I commend it. We have time for one or two more questions. I'm just... Yes, at the back there.
Hi, I'm Helena and I work at LSE. Just leading on from that last question, once you've defined what your idea of success is, how do you go about... trying to sort of change the minds of other people around you, parents or friends or other influencers who might be saying, no, you're wrong, you should be working your way up and every few years getting X more £1,000 a year. And how, like, obviously it's good to have it in your head, but how do you influence those around you to make a bigger change?
Yeah, we have a really good workout in our book that I think is actually a very lighthearted workout. But I think the point is very valid in that regard. So your question is relatively similar in terms of the cultural context, and I think so those things have still apply. You know, understanding that disappointing other people is not a failure. It's not a personal failure. It's just you have a different perspective from somebody else, and reframing that is really, really important. Being very secure in what you're trying to do so that you can withstand that influence around you is really important as well. But this workout we do have in the book is called Dare to Disagree, and the idea behind it is getting comfortable with not being a good girl and not agreeing with what everybody says, and getting comfortable with maybe arguing with people or disagreeing with people. And it's really important, as Alice talked about, you know, the influences on us as little girls, and there's a lot of evidence around the differences between how we bring up little girls and how we bring up little boys, right from when we bring them home from the hospital. I mean, the differences are massive, even between the way people touch and carry a little girl or touch and carry a little boy, how much they will let them cry. So that idea that you want to be a kind of, you don't want to disappoint, that you want to be a good girl, generally tends to be much more ingrained in girls and women than it does in men. So with the idea of Dare to Disagree is you put yourself in a situation where you would have a conversation with somebody who's maybe not a particular friend. So we say in a taxi, but it could be in any kind of situation where people engage you in conversation, and you know, you'll know if you get in a taxi, you get in an Uber, they'll often engage you in a conversation about something that's, or maybe on the radio or something like Brexit, for example. And the idea is that each time you get put into a situation like that, so first of all, deliberately put yourself in those situations, engage somebody in conversation who you wouldn't engage them in, and talk about maybe an issue that it might be a little bit controversial, so you wouldn't normally engage in if you're a person like me who doesn't like confrontation. And then you have to disagree with whatever they say. So you might be anti-Brexit, but if they say they are anti-Brexit, you have to be pro-Brexit, and you have to argue with them about it. And you have to do that in lots of different situations just to get you comfortable with the idea that actually you cannot agree with somebody and it's not a fight. It's just actually quite normal to disagree. It's also cultural. You know, if you're from a British background, we tend to value harmony and to not disagree. If you go into, for example, an Italian house over dinner, they might all be shouting at each other. They don't hate each other. They're just having an argument, and that's okay. So getting yourself... So getting yourself comfortable with that level of, like, I can disagree with somebody. It doesn't mean I don't like them. It doesn't mean I've let them down. It doesn't mean that I've failed them. It just means I have a different opinion, and that's fine. I think over time that will have a big impact.
Okay, we've probably got time for one more question. Anyone like to ask? Okay. Thanks.
Hi, my name's Jennifer. My question is really about confidence. I haven't read the book, so I'm sure there's quite a lot of stuff in there about this, but I think when people have an idea of what they would like out of their career, sometimes the biggest thing that holds you back is a sense that you just can't do it. You just don't have the confidence to make that, perhaps that initial step, or the fear of failure is stopping you from making that initial step. So maybe just some tips on kind of confidence to help kind of overcome that and move towards where you really want to be.
So we talk about confidence, kind of there's like a two-pronged attack, which we probably don't have enough time to go into now, but it's kind of changing the mindset, so that mental ticker tape that's the one that tells you you can't do it even though you can, and the one that everyone else in this room also has, that you're not kind of privy to. So using those belief cycles and trying to interrupt them, as Fenella was mentioning earlier, but also working from the outside in, because so much about how people respond to you is how you present yourself and how you act in certain situations. So we talk about your voice, so slowing down how you speak. We talk about how you stand, you know, your positioning. So we talk about kind of the physical outside in and the emotional inside out. And there is a whole chapter on it in the book, and we probably don't have time now. But I think, as we mentioned before, like the main thing about confidence is that everybody does suffer. And I think accepting that and knowing that is actually kind of the most important step. And knowing that as women, we do tend to suffer more acutely perhaps,
And then using what we say in the book to try and improve your confidence. And know that people, I mean, I've said this before, that we all have different types of confidence. So I feel relatively confident sitting here talking, but, you know, one email that's kind of worded in a way I don't like can kind of take the wind out of my sails, and that my confidence actually doesn't have very deep roots, and that I kind of try and work on, like, deepening my confidence. And so knowing also that confidence is a kind of beast with lots of different, is made up in lots of different ways, and it's not just this black and white concept that you're either in or out of. And I think that if you suffer with low confidence, you know, your brain is already tuned to kind of put yourself down and think that everybody else is fine on the outside. But you know, everybody suffers, men and women, old and young. But, you know, the actual skills to getting there are twofold.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I would just add that that something, again, how Alice put it in the book, and I think how we put it in the book, and I think it's absolutely right, is that it's really important to remember that confidence is a state of mind. It's not a personal attribute, like I'm short, or I've got brown hair, or I've got a relatively low voice. It's a state of mind, so it can be changed. It's your schema might be that you're I'm not a very confident person, I'm a very meek person, but actually that's just something that you've carried through, and that you totally have the power to change that completely. It doesn't mean changing your personality, but you can become a very confident person.
Okay. Well, sadly, we've come to the end of the event. We're now out of time. It's been very enjoyable and informative. Given us an opportunity to reflect on our careers, to take time out and think about how we might go forward in future. So that's been great. But in reflecting on our roles in the workplace, there is a realisation that there is still more to do, and we can make a contribution to achieving our aims just by engaging for 10 minutes a day, keeping that commitment alive. I'd like to think that this afternoon we started a revolution, and it's for each of us to remain committed, believing that we can bring about the changes that we are seeking. I'd like us to offer our special thanks to Fenella and Alice. I believe the world needs more women like you.
Thanks.
Who not only are able to inspire, but can look back and encourage other women to come along with them. I'd also like to thank our hosts, LSE Power, the Professional Women's Network, not just for today, but for all the work they're doing in empowering and encouraging women across the LSE and driving change within the school. Thanks to you all for attending. The Literary Festival continues for the rest of this week, so I hope that you will engage in other events. Looks like a very exciting agenda. Please stay and join us for some refreshments. The book will be for sale, much talked about book, and Alice and Fenella will be on hand to sign the books as well. So thank you very much.